hot. Awful things happen in every apartment house.
Now, this house has a high incidence of unpleasant happenings. In 59, a dead infant was found wrapped in newspaper in the basement.
Hmm, you really rouse my appetite.
Have some more wine.
Welcome to Rosemary's Baby 666, the podcast where we look at every unspeakable 6 minutes and 66 seconds of the horror classic Rosemary's Baby. My name is Susan Tekla Kriglinska, and this is episode 2. We begin this episode with Hutch saying, "Instead, I decided to lie to them." And we end with Rosemary saying, "Oh, it's beautiful." And I have two fabuloso guests this week. One is returning champion cinephile Megan Dooley. Hey, Megan.
Hi. Hello. Back from doing my laundry.
Yes. We also have, I'm so happy to have her back. She was on The Shining 237, and she was on our bonus episode on The Clockwork Orange. We had such a fun discussion. Everybody look that one up. Gina Radcliffe from the Kill by Kill podcast.
Hello. I brought this leg of lamb for us to share while we talk about this.
Excellent. Perfect. Gina is, along with Patrick Hamilton, host of the Kill by Kill podcast. Just tell us a little bit about Kill by Kill.
We, for about the past 3 years now, we have been talking about horror movies, mostly focusing on the characters and little random quirks and strange little background details of the movies. We've already gone through the entire Friday 13th series, and we are currently scraping the bottom of the barrel of the Nightmare on Elm Street series. As of this recording, we just finished the shockingly pro-life The Dream Child. And then we're about to start into the shockingly pro-garbage Freddy's Dead.
What year is that?
I believe that is 1992-3, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. That is the one that is notable most for the fact that it's about 6 minutes in 3D. And it has a special guest appearance by Tom Arnold and Roseanne Barr.
It's that one.
Yeah.
Right.
Good Lord.
I don't remember what they do. I think they're in it for about 10 seconds. But this was at full self-awareness that, you know, we're not talking about a movie about a child murderer anymore. We're talking about, oh, it's Freddy. Let's put Alice Cooper in this movie and Roseanne, and we'll make a portion of it in 3D for no reason.
And then Gina also is a fantastic writer. I know you've written a lot for The Spool.
Trashy television.
I have my own website in which I write about old TV and movies. That's GinaRadcliffe.com. But most of my work right now is at The Spool, which I do mostly movie reviews and some TV recaps. Just finished recapping the TV series on Becoming a God in Central Florida, which is a Showtime series that if you are not watching it, you should watch it because it satirizes pyramid schemes and mixed level marketing schemes, which I'm sure everybody has at least one person on their friends list on social media who is trying to sell them vitamin supplements or scented candles or
cleaning products,
some sort of band that you're supposed to put around your stomach that helps promote weight loss. I still haven't quite figured out how that's supposed to work. But yeah, that season just finished. I recapped the whole season, which is exhausting work. Luckily, I like this show. It's harder if you don't like the show.
Yeah.
Because this is like, oh God, this shit again.
Well, you did a great little essay on pertinent to our interests, Look What Happened to Rosemary's Baby.
Yes.
From 1976. And so we're going to take advantage of your expertise in that area. And after we talk about this 6 minute and 66 second segment, we're gonna have a little discussion about the classic TV horror Friday night special, Look What Happened to Rosemary's Babies.
You can almost hear the air quotes in your voice. You said classic.
Yeah, and so that'll be fun. That'll be really fun. We're going to go through that. Now, this season, we have sponsors. So here's this week's sponsor for today's episode of Rosemary's Baby 666.
Looking for the apartment rental of a lifetime in New York City? Come live at the historic Bramford on the Upper West Side. Since 1884, the Bramford has been home to the cream of the city, Keith Kennedy, Pearl Ames, even the lovely Trench Sisters. Nowadays, the building has been refurbished. We've got an elevator operator on duty 24/7, and newly drilled peepholes on every door. Working fireplaces, of course, a nice view of the park, and plenty of closets. Apartments that were originally 9 rooms have been broken up into 4, 5, and 6 room units. The basement includes several laundry machines alongside chairs and plenty of newspapers to pass the time. With this kind of charm, we would raise the rents if we were allowed. You can no longer not associate yourself with this beautiful New York City residence, the Black Bramford. For an appointment to see available apartments, call Mr. Nicholas at 475-2598.
Very popular with actors.
When I listened to that scene and they said they called it the Black Bramford, all I could think of was that Ram Jam song, oh, Black Bamford, Bam Lam. Bamford had some witches, Bam Lam. They all ate some babies, Bam Lam.
Yeah.
So, yes, Black Bamford.
There are rooms available as we speak, according to our sponsor. So,
rooms are quite affordable, even on a actor's salary.
Yes, amazingly.
So who would have thought that the star of
Luther and Nobody loves
an albatross
could afford the, of course, why wouldn't he?
And what does it get into the swinging world of Yamaha?
Oh, we're getting to that. I just also want to say I guested recently on the wonderful podcast The Projection Booth. We covered Rosemary's Baby. The other guest was Kat Ellinger, who was the editor-in-chief of the horror magazine Diabolique. And so everybody check that out. It was really fun. And thank you to Mike White for inviting me. And then I also want to say, so last week we introduced the character Diego, who is the elevator operator, who is played by Derville Martin. And so just out this week is the Dolomite Is My Name on Netflix with Eddie Murphy. So I just want to say, I saw it. I don't know if you guys got a chance. It just came out.
I haven't had a chance yet.
I saw The Lighthouse last night.
I did too.
Oh, how was it?
It is something.
Yeah, it sure is.
In the best way possible, you will never see any movie quite like The Lighthouse. It is really something.
So that's the director of The Witch, just so people know. Yeah. So yeah. Which is such
and
a great
that it was shot on 35mm black and white double X film, augmenting the Panavision Millennium XL2 camera with vintage belt. In other words, he used all old stuff. This wasn't shot on a handheld digital camera and then turned black and white. He used an old ass movie camera with old lenses and real film.
All right, so I got to see that for sure. Mm-hmm. So I did watch Dolomite Is My Name. It's very good. They've been showing it on the big screen, but it's more of a Netflix movie, but it's very good. Eddie Murphy's great. And so Wesley Snipes plays Derville Martin. And I don't know what Derville Martin's really like. I mean, I know him from the Dolomite movie, and I know him, you know, obviously just these little bits of pieces, but Wesley Snipes certainly does a really amazing portrait of, I assume he must have studied Derville Martin, what he was like in real life. So if that's what he was like, I mean, certainly you didn't recognize Wesley Snipes except for his face. He did a great job of encompassing this personality. So anyway, everybody should definitely watch that. It's really fun. This movie will just make you so happy. It's a really uplifting, sweet movie, actually. So highly recommended. And we'll get back to Derville Martin later in the movie when we see him again. And then the other thing I wanted to say, just going back to last week, so Joe had mentioned that the opening of Rosemary's Baby and the opening of The Shining were kind of similar in that you started out with this, you know, long shot and it's panning over. You're heading for this building that will be the nexus of all of this horror. And of course, the music was so unique. But it occurred to me that also the first thing that happens in both movies after that opening is, in The Shining, it's the interview with Jack, and they're immediately asking him questions about himself, and he's immediately lying, and he's saying, oh, I'm a writer. You know, he never had anything published. He's actually a fired school teacher. And, oh, Wendy's going to love it here. She's a horror movie fanatic. Mm. And I thought that was interesting because, of course, the first few lines of Rosemary's Baby is Mr. Nicholas asking him questions and him just totally making shit up. So anyway, I just wanted to point that out because I just thought that was an interesting little parallel between the two. So that's that. Anyway, all right, so let's move on here, and we have a lot to talk about and get into the episode. So here is the second 6 minutes and 66 seconds of Rosemary's Baby. We open with Hutch pulling a lamb, a very delicious looking lamb, out of his oven, and he said, starting with the last episode. He said, I was tempted to write to the management that you were drug addicts and litter bugs. Instead, I decided to tell them you were wonderful tenants. So, Hutch.
Is he their landlord?
He is, no. So Hutch is, his real name is Edward Hutchins, and right. He is a guy who lived in the same building as Rosemary did, or very close to her when she first moved to New York City from Omaha. And, she, you know, she moved in with a bunch of other young girls, and he kind of took them under his wing as sort of a uncle or father figure. His claim to fame was writing boys' adventure books. Mm. That was his career. And so he's played by, of course, Maurice Evans. So let's just very quickly talk about who Maurice Evans is as we are doing in this podcast, introducing each character. Maurice Evans is most known as a Shakespearean actor, born in 1901. That's a long time ago. And actually, he pronounces his name Morris. And so I should Morris. Probably continue to say Maurice Evans, because that's actually how he prefers it. But it's hard not to say Maurice, because he ended up as Samantha's.
Right. Some people call him Maurice.
That's right. Well, he ended up, coincidentally, as Samantha Stevens on Bewitched's father, and his name was Maurice on that show. So it's a little hard. It's a little hard to separate the two in your brain if you grew up on Bewitched, as
and
did.
And his prior witch experience.
Yeah, I think we all probably grew up on Bewitched and have that embedded in our brain. So he was, as a tyke in England, his father actually was friendly with Thomas Hardy, who wrote Tess d'Urberville.
Oh, good lord.
That's how old he is.
I was going to say, that's pretty that fucking old. Right?
That's hella old.
His father used to put on plays, and he would arrange the works of Thomas Hardy for the stage, and Thomas Hardy thought he was wonderful at it. So Maurice Evans' first role as a little kid was in Far From the Madding Crowd, one of Hardy's plays. Anyway, as he got older, of course, he became a great actor. He worked. He was part of the Old Vic. He starred in 1927 with Laurence Olivier in Journey's End, and that's where he really got discovered. And besides Shakespeare, which he did a million Shakespeare plays. He also did a lot of George Bernard Shaw. And as with most of these incredible classic actors, so the I guess the crossing point was him doing 1968 both Rosemary's Baby and playing Dr. Zaius in Planet of the Apes.
The Forbidden Zone.
a career in the classics.
Yeah. So it's same year, super classy Hutch, and super kind of cheesy, but really well done, Dr. Zaius. And so that's where his career kind of crosses over, as most of these great old actors, into crazy cheesy land of the 70s. From there on in, of course, as we said, he was Samantha's father on Bewitched, but he also was the Puzzler on Batman.
Wow.
Love Boat, you know, Fantasy Island, you name it, all the humiliating things that these wonderful old actors did.
He was in The Girl, The Gold Watch, and Everything.
Yes.
That is a 70s made-for-TV movie title, if there ever was one.
And he was in The Jerk.
He was in The Jerk. That shocks me.
He was the butler. It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Oh, same here. I've seen it so many times.
And I did not, and just like you, I did not remember him in it.
Yeah.
He's the butler.
I was hoping he wasn't Iron Balls McGinty.
And he passed away at the ripe old age of 87. So that's Maurice Evans. Okay, so Hutch. So the dialogue goes, Rosemary says, you're great, Hutch. After telling them, you know, that he was recommending them to the board of the Bramford, he says, wish I could talk you out of it, though. And Guy says, he's pulling your leg, Ro. Indeed, I'm not. And
indeed.
Are you aware that the Bramford has a rather unpleasant reputation around the turn of the century? It's where the Trench sisters conducted their little dietary experiments.
Or he pronounces it dietary. I was like, dietary? Was it botany? What is dietary. Okay, got it.
Yeah, that's one of those weird Brit pronunciations, like how people on the Great British Bake Off pronounce yogurt as yogurt.
Yes.
which is just like, I wind up like, what? Yogurt?
That's some turmeric.
That bothers me more than aluminium. Which they put an extra I in it.
I joked with Gaylord Fields that I'm going to put on a play called The Aluminium Lieutenant.
Yeah, Lieutenant's even worse.
Yes, yes.
Gaylord Fields from WFMU, who will be on our next episode.
Yay!
Episode 3. So look, he's oh God, we recorded that in New York. It is so friggin' funny. It's a great episode. Mm-hmm. All right, so then he says, Keith Kennedy held his parties. He says nothing else about Keith. We know nothing about Keith Kennedy except the last name, Kennedy. It's so funny that Ira Levin would choose that. You know, I mean, 68 is the year Robert Kennedy was shot. But of course, it wasn't that long when he wrote this book after JFK was shot. And, you know, we know all the Kennedy scandals already at that point. And then the Kennedys feature into future scenes in this movie. So it's very interesting that he chose that name.
And I like it's mentioned as like a throw, like, oh, I already knew about Keith Kennedy.
Right. Everybody already knows exactly what he's talking about. He says, Adrian Mercado lived there too. So did Pearl Ames. I love that name.
Yeah,
Pearl
that's
Ames.
A wonderful turn of the century. Pearl and Mabel and Clara. Yeah.
And all and everybody who's having kids now is naming their kids those names.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that.
The era of Jaden and Michaela is over now. I know three different people whose sons all named George.
Yeah. Excellent.
So I like to imagine what it was that Pearl Ames did. We never find out. So he talks about the Trent sisters. He says, the Trent sisters were two proper Victorian ladies. They cook and ate several young children, including a niece. So I looked up cannibalism in New York City.
I know one of the names that's going to pop up.
The top 100 results are that jerk in Queens, the cop, the cannibal cop.
Yeah, but he just did it in his mind. So that shouldn't even count.
Right. I know. Yeah. So, but no, I really actually couldn't find any really good New York City cannibal stories. So please enlighten us.
Albert Fish.
Oh, Albert Fish.
Oh, was Albert York, Fish.
That
yeah.
was New York City? Oh, my gosh.
I think it, or one of the boroughs, if it was
yeah, it
New
was,
York City.
It was, well, he did his misdeeds upstate, but he would come to the city and basically take little poor children. Back, you know, when you were living in a tenement with 12 people, you were kind of, you know, willing to have someone take your kid off your hands for a couple mm-hmm. hours, you know? I mean, I'm not saying I blame the parents for this happening. I'm just saying that different times at all.
Yeah.
You know, if a well-dressed stranger came to your door and said, I'm going to take your child to the fair, you'd say,
right. Certainly.
You know, all right, that's he has one less half a bean I have to give out at dinner time.
Yes.
One of nine children who I don't have to worry about for 30 mm-hmm. minutes. Right?
Exactly, yes. Yes. He would come into the city, you know, grab some poor child, then go upstate and do horrible things to them.
Really yeah. horrible things.
Yeah. What it says one of his nicknames was the Brooklyn Vampire.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe I didn't even think of him.
The serial killer is so horrifying. He's the only one they haven't made a movie about.
And so Rosemary says, oh, lovely. And he says, Adrian Mercado practiced witchcraft. He made quite a splash in the 90s, 1890s, you guys, 1890s, by announcing that he'd conjured up the living devil. Apparently, people believed him, so they attacked and nearly killed him in the lobby of the Bramford. Now, in the book, there's a little bit more information. Adrian Mercado, he claimed to have conjured up Satan, but he had handfuls of hair and claw pairings to prove it.
Excuse me, handfuls of hair and what?
Claw pairings. C-L-A-W.
Oh, claw. Claw. Okay.
So this is, you know, really a foreshadowing to what, you know, the last scene.
Yeah.
But yeah, so hair and claw pairings.
Well, it's actually more like the middle scene where she's not dreaming, you know, something is really happening because she gets raked over by
that's right
goofy looking pair
we see
claws.
The hair we see the hair in the claws. That's right. I forgot about that. I mean, so in the reality of this book, this guy really did conjure up the devil at some point and grab some bits of hair and claws, and who knows what happened to Satan after that. Apparently it didn't take. He showed up. He left. I don't know. It's interesting to think about.
He showed up, saw there weren't any snacks, and left.
He's like, he was like, what is this peas and meatloaf shit that she's serving? I mean, we get to see the food later that Miss Cassavetes serves. And so, you can't completely blame him. So that actually happened. He got chased out. And they tried to kill him in the lobby. So she says, you're joking. Later, the Keith Kennedy business began. So again, you know, just you know all about that. And by the 20s, the house was half empty. And guy says, I knew about Keith Kennedy. I didn't know that Mercado lived there. And the sisters, World War I filled the house up again. Terrific. What the house? The lamb. Cute little.
That's a real sitcom moment.
Yeah.
The lamb.
Oh, you.
And he says they called it the Black Bramford. But hutch, awful things happen in every apartment house.
Bam-a-lam. Sorry. Can't stop thinking about it.
And Hutch says, but this house has high incidence of unpleasant happenings. In 59, a dead infant was found wrapped in newspaper in the basement. So it's funny because, so, you know, in the book, they explain that he went to the library and pulled out all this microfiche about the Bramford and spent like several hours going through microfiche looking for all the articles about this place, which is what I would do, to tell you the truth. Yeah. So I like Hutch.
And I'm glad we were not given the scene of they head for the library and we have to go through. It's like, yes, we know, microfiche, got it.
Also in the book, Hutch tries much harder to convince them not to move into this place. He's quite serious. He's like, really, you guys, don't move into this place. Like, this is not good, you know? And so it's hit a little harder in the book. So you really rouse my appetite, says Guy. Have some more wine.
It's like we're back to A Clockwork Orange. Have some wine.
Notice how shiny Hutch's face is, which I thought was, I always thought that was strange. Like, why didn't they powder, you know, make up, powder his face? But in the book, it says that Hutch is a shiny-faced guy. And I swear to God, Roman Polanski stuck so close to the book that I would put money down that that was a detail. He was like, make his face shiny, because that's what it says in the book.
Morris, come here for a second. Can we smear a little Vaseline on his face? Yes. He's much too matte. I want that shit glistening.
See your face.
I want to be able to style my hair in the reflection of his face.
Also, just really quick, two more points in the book. He actually suggests that they instead go live at the Dakota before they knew where they were filming. And he also points out that the elevator operator at the Bramford, the one from last winter, died in a accident that he can't describe, having to do with an elevator. Oh, now, so Diego,
I think I can guess.
Diego, be warned. But that really does happen. Like, honest to God, I worked
I've heard of them. Yeah.
I worked in a building where that had just happened, like not too long before I started working there.
Something like that just happened a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it happens. Guys, if you ever are in a stuck elevator that is like halfway between floors, stay where you are.
Don't try to, do not try to get on.
Do not
try to get off. That happens like much more than you would think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Also revealed is that they're paying $300 rent, so.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I'm sorry. Hold on a second. I need a minute to. I am going to be apartment shopping again in a few months where my budget, I have to make sure there isn't a toilet in the middle of the living room that says
yes.
$300 a month.
$300.
What was the Dakota? Now, granted, it's not supposed to be the Dakota, but it is the Dakota.
It is, yeah.
Where basically celebrities live.
Yeah. No, like, it is.
$300. I'm sorry. I die. I'm dying.
I know.
What do the kids say? I'm gagging. I'm gagging over this.
Well, actually, just, you know what? We talked at length about the Dakota last week, but I do want to say, actually, in the 60s and 70s, things went really steeply downhill for the Upper West Side. West Side Story, you know, took place basically around that area. I mean, you know, and the Upper West Side is actually still kind of mixed. There's a lot of projects and stuff. But in the 60s and 70s, it did go way, way down. I had Judith Crist, the film critic, as a professor once, believe it or not. She actually had us come to her apartment. And she had gotten it in the, like, around this time. And she said she got it for a song because it was a very dangerous area. So, and there was a time, just to throw that in as a little footnote, where the Upper West Side in this area was very different. And, of course, New York City in itself, like, people used to be able to just look in the Village Voice and find a fucking apartment for, you know, $200 or $100. And you didn't have to fill out a million forms and nobody checked like the last 20 years of your employment. You just moved in, you know, and times are really different. But yeah, of course, it's still crazy to hear it. So anyway, that's that scene. So next scene, we are in, I love how dark this next scene is. We're in this the super dark apartment. They have electricity, but none of the lights are in. So they just, Guy's got a lamp in his hand. And he's got his sneakers on. Now, John Cassavetes did not like acting without his sneakers. This is one of his little weirdo traits. Whenever he had to wear actual solid shoes, like in some scenes, like the party scenes in this movie, he gave Polanski a hard time. He wanted his sneakies. He's that kind of actor.
I want my comfy shoes.
I can't act in I only can act in sneakers, apparently. Mm-hmm. That was John
Cassavetes. I need my special hat. I can't travel without it. We got to go back home and get my hat. It's especially funny with Cassavetes because so much of what he did was, you know, kind of
improvising.
Improvising. But then to, you know, rely on this magical thinking of I need my magical sneakers.
Well, he needed to be super comfortable and super loose. You know, I think loose is probably his thing. But, you know, I think it's really funny because, you know, again, we talk about the expression like Ginger Rogers had to dance backwards and in heels. Women have been wearing uncomfortable shoes while acting since the beginning. You know, it's like, yeah, I got acting sneakers, you baby. But anyway. Sorry, I'm being disrespectful to Mr. Cassavetes. Cassavetes. Let's get this out of the way. I have a glitchy brain. I inherited this from my mother. I'm the kind of person who swaps words all the time. And so the nightmare of having to deal with the name Cassavetes and Cassavetes, both of which names I know very, very well. I've read the book 1,000 times. I've seen the film 1,000,000 times. And I know John Cassavetes very well. But you guys have to just forgive me. Someone recently was kind of making fun of someone else for doing that. And it's like, it's going to happen. It's just like, that's how my brain works. So sorry about that. I will try very hard not to make that mistake, but it's going to happen. Okay, so they are in their dark little apartment. So again, it's interesting. As they walk in, he just keeps the camera stationary and their heads get cut off, and which I think is kind of interesting. There's a lot of cut off bodies in this movie. Mm-hmm. And so they end up in their bedroom, what I think is going to be their bedroom, and they're unpacking, and we hear through the wall, we hear, bring me in some root beer when you come. did that sound like her?
Did she say root beer?
Root beer.
Root beer.
Root beer. Of course she drinks root beer.
Is it Tandis root beer?
So in the book she says, but it's impossible to be 100% sure. If you want my opinion, we shouldn't tell her at all. That's my opinion. So that's the other thing they hear through the wall that wasn't included in the movie. So, you know, it's a little more
information. I'm glad they left that out. It's a bit on the nose.
Yeah. So that's the introduction to Cassavetes. That's our little intro. But we will be meeting them next episode. And this is all very quiet, no music.
Look, these are shelves.
Yes. She looks into the closet, notices that the shelves are loose. So they're just hammering that home. Closet clue.
Takes them out and uses it as a table of sorts. You know, it's because it matters if you have the food 1 inch off the floor.
Yes.
Instead of having it on paper plates on the floor. And then in her specific Omaha accent, Guy, let's make love.
Right. So they're sitting on the floor in the dark. And they're eating tuna and beer. And it's so funny because it's just silent and they're just chewing. Mm. And she does the, Guy, let's make love. So what do you guys think of this sex scene?
It's very, you know, all right, I guess.
Kind of. It's funny because it's just sort of, instead of the typical Hollywood sex scene, you know, the two of them embracing, kissing, sinking to the floor, whatever. It shows the two of them at the same time on opposite sides of this makeshift table.
Yeah.
Clumsily taking off shoes and sweater and pants and bra. And
yeah. How long are they? They're not married very long, right?
No.
So there's a very much an odd mechanicalness to it. It's like, oh, all right.
Yeah, it's hard to read what his reaction is, if he's like, all right, if you want, or if he's going, well, I'm male, of course we'll have sex. You're like, I can't tell quite which one is going
on. Yeah, it's like I'm waiting for one of them to let out an exasperated, all right, I guess this might as well happen.
It's very much shows, like, you know, how she's a good former Catholic of, like, making sure all the lights are off. And taking off your own clothes and kind of like preparing for a doctor's visit, you know, you get yourself in the proper lack of vestments and then you just sort of lie there and think of England. It's just kind of like put slot A.
Tab A to slot B, yeah.
Exactly.
And that to, you know, have them take each other's clothes off would be just a bridge too far. That's a little too intimate with your spouse to unbutton his shirt or something.
It's funny the way he yanks the cord off the, you know, from the lamp. He just, like, yanks it. Like, of course it has to be pitch black. But Ira Levin had written some character synopses when he was plotting the book out in his head. In Rosemary's, he said she likes sex. She's an ex-Catholic. You know, she's her family's
Getting that.
Her family's rejecting her. Yeah, so it's kind of funny. I mean, it's like liberating that she's the one who suggests it. And you know, who knows? Maybe this is a reflection of, like, the future of Roman Polanski movies, like Bitter Moon, where he's trying really hard to be sexy and it just doesn't happen, you know? And
well, I think that the problem is there's two things going on here. I think that Rosemary if she likes it, it's because he likes it.
Right.
On the other hand, I mean, Mia Farrow kind of, she seems like she doesn't really enjoy much. She's just got this kind of very, you know, fragile look and persona that she doesn't enjoy sunlight. She doesn't enjoy being around people. And I don't get that your passionate affair with Frank Sinatra or not. I don't really buy. I wouldn't buy
they
that
were
she
married.
That she,
yeah, married. Was this a snapshot from the Sinatra house?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's possible. I don't get the impression that she enjoyed that kind of thing much in real life either. I mean, I could be wrong. She could be a total freak. Yeah. I have no idea. But she just kind of has that very, I don't like being touched kind of look to her.
She's got the little girl vibe. This fits into that. Like the little girl who's maybe, you know, like sex is something she's just learned or something. Mm-hmm. By the way, this cute little dress she's wearing was a real dress of hers. That was one of her dress. Her personal collection. That little yellow flower, baby doll, A-line.
Like smock, a shift.
Smock, yeah, shift dress. So anyway, again, gives her the appearance of a four-year-old.
It's kind of, I guess it was sort of the time of Lily Pulitzer's dresses became popular.
And Mia was just a fashion icon. She got that haircut, and a lot of other women got that haircut. It turns out nobody looks good with that haircut except Mia Farrow.
Yes. Maybe Twiggy.
And Twiggy, yeah.
That's about it.
Just to close out the scene, I like his last line where he's like, shh, I think it's the Chuan sisters.
The shoo-in,
I think that's cute. That's the only moment in the whole movie where I'm like, okay, I can see being attracted to this guy.
Yeah, he seems like a fun guy to go together and hate watch something, you know?
Yes, right, yes, exactly. Like, go to a bad movie and just, like, crack each other up. Yeah, he'd be good for that.
Yeah, he would have the nastiest things to say.
So, all right, so that's that. And now we transition into the delightful, you know, the pretty, like, Rosemary's Theme music, and she's putting the house together.
The upbeat, yes, but still, la, 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 la,
yellow,
la, la.
Yellow everywhere, and they're painting, and they're putting up wallpaper, and then she hears Guy's commercial is on the TV. She's all excited because her husband's on TV. So it's a Yamaha motorcycle commercial. Now, this is real product placement. They actually gave Roman and Guy motorcycles. So there was a real deal. They actually did a deal with Yamaha. So just so you know, I don't know what year the movie industry clued into product placement. So I don't know if this is a really early version of it or if it had been done before, but they were doing it in 68, just so you know. Mm. Now, in this beginning part of the movie, Polanski and Cassavetes were getting along very well. So they got these motorcycles and they took off driving around and had a great time. But that will change in the near future.
And incidentally, how old is John Cassavetes here?
Like, I don't know. Like 30, maybe? Well, 35?
Because he looks a lot older than what he actually is. And it's also funny to see him in a Yamaha commercial.
He was 40. Where... He was actually 40 when he
was
40.
Oh, wow.
40. Yeah. Wow. Holy shit.
He's supposed to be like 10 years older. I mean, in the book, they're actually there's a 10 years difference between them. So,
well, it's especially funny because I think in the Yamaha spot, he's supposed to be kind of this neophyte, you know, kind of like a younger adult buying his first bike. And I feel like he's almost not really suited for that role. And it's funny because the guy is like, you know, you should really get with the swinging world of Yamaha. And he says, you know, let's take a ride. And Cassavetes completely oversells the, okay.
Exactly. Yamaha is race bred for champions. As you can see, we have a model for every kind of riding. You know, you really should discover this swinging world of Yamaha. Why don't you get on, have a ride? Come on. Come on, let's go. Okay. Let's go. So yeah, it's nicely done because it is an embarrassing commercial. Like, you could see him just, you know, if you were him, if you were this very prideful, you know, I'm a stage actor, you could see that he would be really embarrassed to be in this commercial. And she'd be all excited.
Of course.
And he'd be like, no, this sucks. In the book, he's an Anison commercial, so it's even worse.
Anison pays good money.
It does pay good. They actually say in the book that he's paid well for it. So, okay.
By the time he comes back home, she's redone the closet. Everything is white and bright and
ta-da!
yellows everywhere, white and yellows.
She's so proud of herself. She gingham contact papered the closet. It's sort of funny because she's like, look, and he's like, it's great. And I don't know if that's great acting on his part doing Guy Woodhouse or if it's just lazy acting doing John Cassavetes. But in any case, he's definitely.
It works either way. Yeah.
Not too impressed. So she's in the basement now, and we are introduced to a new character, and that is played by a woman named Victoria Vetri, which is funny enough.
Under the name Andrea Dorian, which is also funny.
Angela Dorian.
That's yes. Hilarious.
So they're in the basement, and we see this woman at the other washing machine. And so let's just say who she is. So her name in the credits is Angela Dorian, but her real name is Victoria Vetri, which is funny because that's what Rosemary calls her, says she resembles that actress. So it's, as we'll see in the dialogue. She was born in 1944 in L.A. She went to Hollywood High. She got into the whole business. And she was supposed to be, apparently, I'm not absolutely sure about this, but supposed to be maybe the voice stand-in for Natalie Wood in West Side Story, but yeah. Didn't want to do it, apparently.
And some pipes.
Yeah. She also auditioned for Lolita with Stanley Kubrick.
Wow.
And of course, Sue Lyon got that part, but I could almost see her doing it. She did a lot of television. She did Ozzy and Harriet. She later did, Batman, Mission Impossible. Everybody's done Batman. I've noticed that. Batman is like, it's amazing how many people did Batman. There's just endless Batman. All right, Mission Impossible, Hogan's Heroes, Perry Mason. She did like a million little bit parts in TV. Mm-hmm. She's known for being, right before this film, she was a Playmate of the Month in 67.
And then the year.
And then she was elected for the year and she got all kinds of lovely prizes from.
Yeah, tell them what she won.
Ski outfits, some super amazing car.
A pink car that I think was an AMC.
Yeah. She has it on her website. You could check it out.
Oh my God, she still has it.
Maybe. I don't know. But she's proud of it. She's very proud of it, which she should be. Mm. And a couple of movies she ended up in of note were When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth and Invasion of the Bee Girls, which were girls who turned into bees.
Oh, that's a hilarious movie that uses the word bawling.
Oh, God. That was Megan's takeaway.
Yes, it's a movie where somebody says, we bawled and bawled and bawled.
We bawled and we bawled and we bawled till he dropped dead.
Touché.
That was 1973. In 2010, she shot her husband in the shoulder. I obviously don't know the real story, but rumor is alcohol was involved and that he may have been abusive to her. He actually was quite badly injured and almost died. She arrested for attempted murder, but she pled attempted voluntary manslaughter and spent like 8 years in the clink.
Wow.
Got out in April 2018, last year. So shout out to Victoria Vetri. We are happy you are on the outside and we love you in this movie.
Yes.
So they're in the basement. She's staring at her and she says, I'm sorry, I thought you were Victoria Vetri, the actress. So that's really cute that they actually use her real name. So she says, a lot of people think I'm Victoria. I don't see any resemblance. And they talk about that. She says, my name is Terry Gianofrio. Nice to meet you. I'm Rosemary Woodhouse. We're new tenants here. And she says, I'm staying with the Castavets, the seventh floor. And they realize that they live right next to each other and all that stuff. And then Rosemary's trying to remember the name of the woman who lived in her apartment, Mrs. Gardenia. Now, in this scene, for me, for like the first three episodes of this podcast, like what we cover, I think Mia Farrow's acting is actually very stiff. I think she really blossoms into this role. I think this is a good example of she's still a very young actress who's, even though she'd done Paint and Place, which of course was great practice for acting, but she certainly to me seems very awkward for the first bunch of scenes of this movie. And then she just, is Oscar worthy, midpoint of this movie.
I like her Rosemary's little itty bitty pointless pigtails in this
scene.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, little girl popped pigtails, where you give a child or an infant pigtails before they even have enough hair to
just enough hair I can gather in this tiny little makeup brush sized pigtail.
Because we didn't have tape to tape a bow on her head.
So she says, Gardenia, she was real good friends with the Castavets. She used to grow herbs. They used to cook with it, blah, blah, blah. They talk about the herbs. Ask, what does your husband do? He's an actor. No kidding. What's his name? Guy Woodhouse. And say it with me, guys. He was in Luther. And nobody loves an albatross. And he does a lot of television and radio.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, fake titles in movies are always really bad.
Oh, yes.
Because I thought about that with the whole, nobody loves an albatross.
And Luther, yes.
And I just can't figure out, why that is something that Hollywood does so badly.
And then I love the fact that they're saying, I watch TV all day long.
She says, G. I love G. I love the any use of the word G in an old, I watch TV all day long. I'll bet I've seen him.
Yeah.
And they talk about how they hate the basement. Oh, and there's a crash. There's something shatters.
I'm surprised you don't hear meow. A cat has to go along with it. It's like spooky.
I do wonder what shattered.
But it sounds like something glass, like a bottle broke.
I think it's the forces trying to spook them. She says, oh, this gives me the creeps. Why don't we come down here and do laundry together? Then she says, oh, and I've got this good luck charm. And we're introduced to the tennis ball of Rosemary's Baby. I was really into the tennis ball in The Shining.
And now you have the tennis ball.
Now we've got the tennis ball.
Yep.
So that's the second 6 minutes and 66 seconds. So Gina, I actually forgot to ask, tell us your relationship to this lovely movie.
I actually came to this movie pretty late. I knew about it. It's one of those sort of like Gone with the Wind where even if you don't see it, you feel like you sort of have, because so much of it has been the blueprint for so many other supernatural and you know, devil worshiper movies. And it's still, you know, far and above the best in that genre because it's very low key. A lot of it is suggested more than seen. I know a lot of people have issue with implying that you could sort of see what the baby looks like at the end, but I don't actually think that's supposed to be the baby. I think that is Satan kind of looking over everything and laughing, because I think that whatever she sees is better left to the viewer's imagination.
Yeah.
And of course, this is something that, as we'll get to in the unofficial sequel, that's been completely done away with, in that he's a normal looking kid.
Yeah.
If you're really into kind of more modern horror and you expect a lot of things to, you know, boom, 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 happen right away, you're going to be disappointed, because it takes its sweet time in setting up the scene and the mood. And, you know, we were talking a little bit at the beginning of the episode about The Lighthouse, and I think actually Robert Eggers is very good at this. I think that he and Ari Aster are both, you know, for being modern filmmakers in the horror genre, are both very good at starting out very slow and then all of a sudden just taking a hard right turn into everything suddenly just lots of shit hitting the fan at once, you know, everything immediately going to hell. In this case, possibly literally subverting the audience's expectations into, you know, nothing's happening. Oh shit, everything's happening. It's like being on a roller coaster that just goes right over the edge.
Yeah.
He does a whole lot of little tricks in the movie. It's one of those movies that makes you misremember things.
Yeah.
Like the way that people think that, oh, the way the baby looks in the end, and you never get to see what the baby looks like in the end.
No, but you see something.
Well, no, you don't see the baby.
Right, no, but you see something.
You see dad.
And that's what I think people are confusing it with. Remember in the remake of Dawn of the Dead when they showed the zombie baby and it just kind of ruined the whole effect because it just and you know, I think just the idea of a zombie baby is so horrifying that, you know, you could have just stuck with it making like real like, you know, weird little
wah, I want brains, wah,
you know, monster baby noises instead of showing this very obvious puppet. And it just kind of takes you out of the whole scene. You just sometimes what your mind can come up with is way more horrifying than what someone can do with CGI or practical effect. Like I said, you're right. She's a little shaky, Mia, when she comes into this movie. You know, she kind of, you know, whether deliberately or not, she kind of looks like a little deer, just kind of learning how to walk. And then, like, by the end of the movie, I mean, her reaction to what she sees is amazing. There's probably not even anything in there. It's probably an empty bassinet.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's everything.
Yeah, she's 100% authentic in the way she reacts to it.
But you wouldn't have the illusion even, I mean, you're right, it probably is a little bit of people thinking they saw, you know, they saw the eyes of the father. But really, it's her reaction is so bone-chilling. You know, you feel like you just saw something horrifying.
And the other guests describe he has his father's eyes and his claws and his tail. The baby has a tail.
Yes.
A tail. Is this like a little red hot baby, you know, with like
the little beard?
Yeah. Or, you know, does he look like Richie Rich, or does he have the yellow eyes like his dad and, you know, like the cover of the Black Sabbath album, you know? But yeah, it's like your mind makes it up.
Yeah, it's definitely a masterwork in subtlety, which a lot of horror directors don't bother with, and they should.
So I was gonna say, speaking of what Rosemary's Baby actually looks like. Wanted to take this opportunity because Gina, like I said, had written a great essay on Look What Happened to Rosemary's Baby. So I will put a link to that on my website, rosemarysbaby666.com. So you can just easily get there. So I wanted to get her on and talk about this. October 29th, 1979. It was Friday night. You were sitting in front of your TV, sitting through commercials for the Milford Plaza and Crazy Eddie's. And this was the movie we were watching. Instead of watching Quincy and Rockford Files, for this one night, you were watching this. First of all, the title?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's like that gif of that cat figure where it's just kind of holding its arms up. Like, what? What is that?
What?
like, you know, like somebody says, look at him. Look what happened to him.
I am constantly saying, whatever happened to Rosemary's, you know, like I can't, it's like impossible not to conflate it with whatever happened to Baby Jane. You know, it's really too similar.
It's a misleading title because he's not even a baby in it. He's a boy and then he's a grown man for most of it.
Let me first say one thing in ahead of time. So Ira Levin did write a sequel to Rosemary's Baby in 1997, Son of Rosemary. This has nothing.
But that was long.
So everybody knows, this has nothing to do with that. He wrote it after this movie came out, so they're completely unaffiliated.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the original movie.
Yeah.
Absolutely no one involved in the original movie had anything to do with, except Ruth Gordon.
Ruth Gordon needs a paycheck,
which makes me so sad because she was just on this downward decline. It was in decline, and like the next year she was starring in like Every Which Way But Loose.
Yeah.
And like Clint Eastwood's like horny aunt. She's aunt. I was never quite sure about that. That relationship. Now, I mean, granted, she was 150 years old by then. She could do whatever the hell she wanted. And she just kind of shows up in this movie every now and then to, like, you know, do an old lady wisecrack and then kind of wander off screen again.
Yeah,
but, like,
she's parodying herself from the original movie.
She is. Basically. Oh, yeah. She totally is. And, I mean, she's the only one that's not taking... Everybody else that is taking it very seriously.
Yeah.
She's not. So I guess that gives her a pass. But, yeah, you've got Mia Farrow, is now played by Patty Duke.
Yeah.
Who is gone in like the first 15 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah. So first of all, let's say the person who wrote this was Anthony Wilson. He was the guy who actually created and put together the Planet of the Apes television series, and that was very successful. But he then died very shortly after this movie was out, like within a couple years.
Cursed production.
Curse of the Rosemary's Baby.
Ooh. How old was he when that
happened?
Like 52.
Okay.
People just died younger back then.
Yeah. I couldn't find any information. Uh-huh. There's no information on this guy. Let's just quickly talk about some of the actors who were in this. Ray Milland.
Ray fucking Milland. Good God.
So he started in movies in the 20s. Lost Weekend, Dial M for Murder, The Uninvited.
Ministry of Fear.
and then in 72, he did the doubleheader that changed it all. Frogs and The Thing with Two Heads.
Goddamn right.
Yep.
God bless him.
Putting his head on the brother of a soul brother.
Oh,
yeah.
It's such a good, I grew up watching that. I have such a warm, fuzzy feeling about that movie. But oh my gosh. But he's really good in this. I mean, you know, he's a smooth...
He's a different Roman, though, because the original Roman, why is his name eluding my brain?
Sidney
right
Blackmer.
Sidney Blackmer has kind of a gentle warmth to him.
Yeah.
Where Ray Milland's version is always seems like he's peeved and he wants that ham he was promised at Christmas.
Yeah. And then everybody knows Patty Duke. I don't have to tell you who she is.
Mm-hmm. Yes. A hot dog makes her lose control. We know.
Stephen McHattie, this was kind of his biggest role, but he did a lot of little things. Some people remember him as the psychiatrist on Seinfeld.
He was in Watchmen. He had a small but memorable part, but I think, for my money, the best Stephen McHattie performance is in a movie called Pontypool.
Uh-huh. Which is that's him.
Yeah,
he's great in that. Yeah,
he that's a current movie. So like he's about 70 now, and he has this like kind of Tom Waitsy sort of hoarse voice now, which is pretty excellent. It's a very unique take on zombies. I highly recommend it. He is honestly really really great in it.
I think he's good in this movie.
He's not bad. I mean, for a very silly movie.
Yeah,
he's made the decision to take it seriously, which is probably good. Guy is now played by George Maharis, which
George
is
Maharis, yes.
a downgrade.
Was in Route 66 and The Satan Bug.
an extremely poor replacement for John Cassavetes.
I'm not crazy about him. Yeah, he's the wig he's wearing. Oh my God, it's crazy. Yeah. So anyway, Donna Mills, I think she wasn't really famous at this point, and then she went on to Knott's Landing, of course. Tina Louise was in Stepford Wives. I mean, everybody thinks of her as Gilligan's Island.
Talking about her husband making her a custom-made rubber suit.
Yeah, I love her in that. So we should say, so this is divided up into three. This is a very confusing movie, first of all.
It seems to be made of, you know, like a Stroop waffle is made of glued together pieces of old dessert.
Yeah.
But except that uses caramel, and here we don't have the caramel, and it's just a mess and not good.
They've added a lot to their own mythos that wasn't there in the original Ira Levin story, in which he apparently doesn't know that he is the son of Satan, and he is also not the Antichrist yet, which is a little unclear.
This, although he has a room in a nursery that has a fucking swastika.
Yeah, and a black teddy bear, which cracks me up. God.
I did want to start with just describing the opening, because the opening is really funny. So you open with them recreating the last scene of the Mia Farrow movie, badly.
Just like very badly.
A bad recitation of that scene. You just hear it, you know, and you drift into this child's room, this little boy's room, which is Adrian. So there's like a mobile over his bed, and it's like, you know, one of those baby mobiles, and it's a Chucky doll hanging upside down, a really scary devil thing, a shrunken head, an African shrunken head. Yes.
A real shrunken head.
Something like a Nazi helmet with a little baby-sized Nazi helmet. I don't know. I think if you birthed the son of Satan, he wouldn't need these things to influence him.
No, that's what I love about Rosemary's Baby is that the Satanists next door are perfectly normal.
Yes.
They don't wear black. They aren't young, cool, you know, hipsters that look like...
Right. They don't like the Munster House.
They don't look like the Crow or something.
For some reason, I guess they figure they have to keep kind of directing him towards being evil because he...
Half human, yeah.
Again, I would think that if you were the son of Satan, being evil would kind of come a little naturally.
So, I mean, I guess the thing is, he's supposed to be fighting against, like, he's got the human side, which is good, which is a laugh, because, like, humans are so good, right? But, so, he's got the human side, which is supposed to be good, and then the Satan side, which is supposed to be bad, and it's like this conflict within him. So, Rosemary's dispatched in the first act. There's act one is Rosemary, the book
of
Rosemary.
She's pretty much useless. There's a fairly memorable scene in which she gets stuck on a bus and there's no driver.
Tina Louise's character kind of kidnaps him. You know, she lies to Rosemary and kind of gets Rosemary on the bus.
And the bus takes her away. We don't know where. I guess she dies. I don't know. We never.
I picture it going off a cliff, you know, the classic. We assume that her bus went off a cliff and that's it.
Which, if you recall the video for Van Halen's Hot for Teacher, there is a very similar scene.
Like poor Waldo. Yeah. Sit down, Waldo. You too, Patty Duke.
I part of me thinks I couldn't possibly be inspired by that, but at the same time, like, how could it not be?
Tina Louise takes over, and she's being influenced by the witches, you know, by Minnie and Roman somehow to do this. And she ends up raising him in some crazy little casino with a stage and a nightclub, and he's like the house band, you know, basically. He grows into this rock star. So he's reaching Jesus's age. There's a lot of Bible reference in this. He's kind of reached Jesus's age. So he's at the age where, you know, they think he's ready to take on his duties, but they're not sure it's going to take, which is interesting, right? So they're always like, we'll see what happens, but we're going to have this ceremony for his birthday. They're all the Satanists are flying in to celebrate his birthday and to do some kind of ceremony to transition him.
My favorite thing, and I mentioned this in my write-up, that I love that the birthday party for Adrian, all the decorations are in black and red. There's an open box of joints on the counter, which is like, that's like the most evil thing they can come up with. It's like, oh my God, we're just giving out these joints to people.
I think the things that signify evil in this movie, I noticed for some reason, because you had mentioned the pot in your article, and I was thinking, and when they're on the bus, she's giving him a sandwich and he opens it up and just starts eating the meat. And meat eating, for some reason, meat eating always signifies evil in these movies.
Like, yes, Atkins diet.
Meat shaming. There's a lot of meat shaming. So they give him a drink, just sort of like a big gold goblet full of something that has plums in it that Minnie made. He drinks it up and he goes into this crazy kind of trance, and they put mind makeup on him.
Putting him in a vest with no shirt, always a good look. And then putting some sort of like, you know, glam rock like mind makeup on him, which it does not make him look satanic. It makes him look like he is going out for Halloween as David Bowie.
Now, we should say, mimes were, like, just as pirates were big in the 80s, mimes were really big in the 70s. There was Shields and Yarnell. There was Moominshots. There was the movie Shanks by William Castle. Kate Bush was trained by a mime to be Kate Bush.
Jessica Lange did mime training under Marcel Marceau. Yeah.
And David Bowie.
David Bowie.
Yes.
So just so everybody knows, because it makes no sense when you look at it now, but if you were raised in the 70s like some of us, we remember the mime years and how cool it was to be a mime. So that's
the time of the mime. If my favorite use of a mime is in Q. The guy is, I believe he's a police officer undercover, dressed as a mime and with the face paint, only to have the Q thing reach down and pull the guy's head off, I think, or he bites him in half. And the guy reacts as a mime would, which is just the silent open mouth of screaming, but no sound coming out. I love it. That's one dedicated cop for you.
Yeah. So the climactic scene in all this, but there's still so much more to go. But the really climactic scene in this is, so he's drunk on whatever they gave him. He's kind of tripping in his mime face. And he goes up on stage and starts doing the goofiest dance you ever freaking saw. And there's a strobe going on, and you see like these masks. They do kind of the Exorcist thing where they kind of flash these scary faces. And it's all like, you know, ancient devil stuff. And as he's doing this, we didn't mention he has this best friend who had gone to divinity school, who's this supposedly holy guy. His name is Peter Simon.
Oh, God.
He's on a fence, and he stretches his arms out, and it's Jesus on the cross, and he's electrocuted. There's a storm going on. Some electrical wire comes down. I don't know. Who knows what's going on, but he gets completely electrocuted, and Adrian watches it through the window as he's on stage freaking out. And then next thing you know is part three, which is the Book of Andrew, I think. And he wakes up in a mental hospital to Donna Mills as his nurse. She's helping to nurse him back. And, you know, turns out he's in for the criminally insane. Donna Mills helps. We never learn her name, I don't think. She helps him bust out. Takes him to a hotel.
Database has her as Ellen.
Oh, Ellen. Okay.
I don't remember there being a biblical Ellen.
No. And the wonderful little twist here is Ellen somehow is also kind of half demon. Right? Is that
well? She's definitely on the side of the cast member. She basically rapes him.
Yeah,
because they've decided that he is no longer suitable to be the son of Satan. So they're just gonna start all over again.
Yeah,
I mean, another 25 years. What? They're all like 87.
Yes,
they have plenty of time to get this right.
Yep.
So she gives him some wine, and he goes, "There's an undertaste." Your eyes just roll.
This is the second. This is the second time this poor man has been drugged.
Yeah,
like he's kind of a weirdly sympathetic character.
Because
he has no idea what's going on. Everybody's drugging him. He's getting people are raping him, and it's just like this poor man. You know.
In any case, they want to start. He didn't take as the Antichrist, and so they're giving it another go, and she's the vessel. She's the vessel.
Drawing board. Yep.
When they have their sex scene, Donna Mills and Stephen McHattie, there's a shot of her as a black bird that has to be seen.
God.
It's a really short scene.
Wow.
It's the weirdest fucking thing. So in the meantime, they keep telling Guy that Adrian's going to eventually kill him. They're just messing with Guy through the whole movie. Like, they're just messing with his head. And so he decides to kill Adrian. So Guy comes showing up as they exit the hotel after post-coitally, and Guy comes driving up with his car and tries to hit them. He hits Ellen with this car, trying to run over Adrian, and
should have used his trusty Yamaha motorbike to
I
do
know.
So.
No, but so he flips over and he's dead. So Guy's dead. And we assume, it seems like she was hit, you know, so we assume she...
And Adrian's just gone. He just wanders away. We don't hear anything more about what happens to him. Look what happens to Rosemary's baby.
The answer is shrug emoji.
Right.
Yeah, you know, he'd be like 70 now, you know, could be just wandering around.
So the conclusion is we see the Castevets in a hospital and Ellen is waking up. They've saved her. She's okay. She's pregnant and she's fine. And that's how they end it. Yeah. And you don't, that's it. So anyway, so this movie has been perpetually for years on YouTube for free. Nobody cares about the copyright. Nobody.
It's a terrible rip. It's like you'll have that authentic, like, you know, your dad messing around with the rabbit ears experience. It's all grainy and washed out. It's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, which is the way it should be seen, frankly. All right, so that is Look What's Happened to Rosemary's Baby. Thank you so much, Gina Radcliffe.
Oh, thank you.
For being on.
God, yes.
And thank you, Megan.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
All right.
Happy Halloween.
Huge thanks to Gina Radcliffe from the Kill by Kill podcast and The Spool. And of course, our in-house cinephile, Megan Dooley. And one thing we strangely forgot to mention, as far as Look What Happened to Rosemary's Baby, is we forgot to mention that Sam Osteen was the director. Sam Osteen was the editor for Polanski's Rosemary's Baby, and he was the director for this almost kind of sort of sequel. So that's really interesting, and I'm sorry I forgot to mention that. We had talked a little bit about his career and that he had done this last week. And also, just as of yesterday of this recording, there was the death of Robert Evans, the man who was really responsible for putting this whole movie together. So, and of course, he did a million other amazing things. I really do encourage you to either read his book or watch the documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture. I'm sorry, we're not going to be able to talk too much about that next week, also because the next podcast episode is pre-recorded, so I won't really be able to dig into talking about him there either. But just wanted to acknowledge the passing of Robert Evans. So rest in peace to him, and thank you, sir, for delivering us this beautiful movie. Again, next week, WFMU's Gaylord Fields will be joining us. As of the recording, he had never seen this movie. He's not a horror fan, and we had so much fun with that last time when he was on The Shining 237, and so he is back, and it is such a friggin' funny episode. And also Megan Dooley joins us, and they're pals, and it's just a blast. And please follow me on Twitter and on Facebook under Rosemary's Baby 666 or The Shining 237. And also, hey, follow me, Susan Tekla Kruglenska. I also like it when people do that. Please tune in for our next episode, episode 3, in which we will hear poor Terry saying, "I'd be dead by now if it wasn't for them. That's an absolute fact."